You're listening to Learner, an audiobook by Trevor Reagan from thelearnerlab.com. Chapter 9, Fear, Emotions, and Learning. In section 1, the key point we were trying to make is that we need to take action in order to grow. And ideally, this action stretches us a bit out of our comfort zone. In section 2, we said, believing we can grow, developing this growth mindset, is an essential tool to help us take that sort of action. But our job is not done, and I'll prove it to you. Has there ever been something you believed you could learn, but you still didn't do it? If you're a human, the answer to that question is yes, of course. It happens to us all the time. Having a growth mindset is an essential tool to becoming a better learner, but it's not the only tool. Because remember, there were two big obstacles we identified to learning. Yeah, our fixed mindset stories, but the other is fear. Fear gets me all the time when it comes to dancing. Deep down, I know dancing is a skill that I could get better at. Of course, some people are better at dancing than others, but everyone can get better at dancing. So technically, I have a growth mindset towards dancing. I believe it's a skill that I could build. But anytime I have an opportunity to dance, to take some action, to get some practice and reps, I'm standing on the side. And it's not because I all of a sudden slip into a fixed mindset. No, I'm standing on the side because I don't want to look bad. I don't want to look stupid. I don't want to be bad at dancing in front of others. That's fear keeping me in the zoo, not my fixed mindset. I think we could all agree that fear and just discomfort as a whole, all these tough emotions, stress, anxiety, fear, they hold a lot of power over us, especially when it comes to learning and performance. We usually don't perform at our best when we're feeling stressed, anxious, fearful, and we definitely don't learn at our best. I think those tough emotions affect learning on two sides of the fence. One side is they sort of rob us of opportunities. We might just not do something because we feel fear or nervous or stressed. And the other side is when we're actually in a situation feeling all these tough emotions, we're not going to extract as much growth from the challenge or situation itself. When we're feeling these tough emotions, we usually don't perform well, and we usually don't learn well. So what do we do? On the surface, this seems like a simple answer. In fact, a researcher from Harvard Business School, Allison Wood Brooks, asked a similar question on one of her studies. You're in a workplace, and you're tapped to give a talk in front of everybody, like 500 people. This obviously makes you a bit uncomfortable and nervous. What's the best advice to tell yourself or someone else? Think about your answer for a second. So they gathered hundreds of responses. They tally them up. 91% of the respondents said something to the effect of calm down, don't be afraid. That makes total sense. That's sort of our default approach to talking about fear, stress, anxiety, these tough emotions. Calm down. Don't be afraid. Don't worry. We've all said that. We've all heard that. What we're going to go through in the next few chapters is the research that shows that's exactly the wrong approach. As far as topics that I've learned in the past 10 years studying the learning process, this is the one that's helped me the most, and it's not even close. What the research says about dealing with and overcoming fear and other tough emotions. To jump in, we need to start with, well, where do they come from? It ends up, emotions are wired in. They come from a region of our brain called our amygdala. Some people call this your lizard brain. Doesn't matter what you call it. We know a few things about it. First, we all have an amygdala. It's like the size of two almonds. It lives kind of by our brain stem. It's there for survival. It's there to keep us safe and alive. And one of its most common tactics to keeping us safe and alive is it generates fear and discomfort to steer us away from dangerous situations.
That's what fear is, a warning of danger. Being afraid is nature's way of reminding us that we should do something to avoid the danger.
I could go through 100 more examples of why fear and all these tough emotions are really adaptive. They're really important. They keep us safe. But there's a problem.
There's something else about fear that I don't think you quite understand, Billy.
What's that?
Well, sometimes when you become afraid, there isn't anything that's really dangerous.
Our amygdala, our lizard brain, doesn't really know the difference between the good challenges in life and the dangerous ones. It doesn't know the difference between the good and bad risks either. So its tactic is simple. It tries to avoid them all. Four things that can really enhance fear and discomfort: uncertainty, attention, change, struggle. Of course, there's more than that, but these are four big ones. These four things are usually present in most dangerous situations. But the tough thing is, almost every good learning opportunity involves some sort of uncertainty, attention, change, struggle. The way it works is simple. When those four things are around, fear and discomfort will be around. And more times than not, when we feel that discomfort, we try to avoid the thing that's causing it, which is a fantastic idea when we're in danger. But when it comes to learning, this tactic of avoiding the thing that causes the discomfort robs us of opportunities to grow. You're in a meeting. You're sitting there. You have a question. You have an answer. But you don't ask, don't answer. Has that ever happened to you? Of course it has. If you're a human, the answer to that question is yes, happens to me all the time. Now we're starting to understand what's going on. We don't ask, we don't answer because we feel weird. We feel uncomfortable. That weird is coming from the amygdala. Which two of the four variables are present when it comes to speaking up in front of others? Yeah, uncertainty and attention. Uncertainty is this might be the wrong answer, the wrong question. Attention is, if I speak up, everyone's listening and most people are looking at me. Uncertainty plus attention equals discomfort. And if we don't ask, don't answer, that's kind of the zoo tiger move. That's our lizard brain keeping us in the zoo, robbing us of this small opportunity to grow. Let's rewind it way back to high school. We have a paper due in 2 weeks. What day are we writing that paper? If you're like me, it's the night before or sometimes the morning of if I'm feeling feisty. Now, maybe some people listening to this would write it 2 weeks before, and that's great. We all procrastinate more than we wish we did, though. All of us have that in common. What we don't realize is sometimes procrastination, putting things off, that's coming from the lizard brain too. Let's use the paper example. Every night leading up to the due date, we have a choice. Sit down, do the research, write the paper, or watch Netflix. Which one you think my lizard brain wants? Oh yeah, Netflix every time. But why? What's it trying to avoid now? You got it. Struggle. You're starting to see how this system works. It's not that complicated. Our lizard brain doesn't necessarily weigh out our choices in much detail. Oh, I could write a paper tonight or watch Netflix. No, its world is more cut and dry. Through its lens, it's we could struggle right now or not struggle right now. And it's always going to choose, let's not struggle. No matter the situation we're in, it's going to try to gravitate away from these four variables. It wants certainty, not uncertainty, to avoid attention rather than receive it, to avoid struggle rather than struggle, to avoid change rather than change. Of course, we override this system all the time, but this is a part of our brain we have to be aware of. This is why it's hard to work out for an extended period of time. Remember, working out is struggling on purpose, and a part of our brain is really wired to avoid this struggle. A common tactic I use to sort of justify my choices, I call it downgrading struggle. So instead of recording these chapters like I should have 2 days ago, I've cleaned my house twice. Yeah, I'm feeling productive, feeling like I'm doing the right thing, but in reality, I'm just choosing the thing that involves less uncertainty, attention, change, struggle.
What'd you say? Just for the record, he did not clean the house even once.
Okay, here's the real list of things I did besides recording these chapters. I Zillowed houses for sale in Boulder, Colorado, Maui, Hawaii, Los Angeles, Des Moines, and Missoula, Montana. I watched J. Cole's LA Leakers freestyle about 42 times. I watched all of Squid Game and spent more time on TikTok than I'll even admit. I read all of Shea Serrano's new book, Hip Hop and Other Things, and I designed a book cover for this book, even though we don't actually have a book. When we're in danger, this system of our amygdala creating tough emotions is fantastic. It recognizes dangerous situation, creates the signal, and we avoid them and stay safe. But when it comes to learning, more times than not, this system will send us in the wrong direction. The argument I made in the growth mindset section of the book is that our fixed mindset stories rob us of action and opportunities that could help us grow, and they do. The argument I'm making now is so does fear. And this happens to all of us every day in big and small ways. We have a question, but we don't ask. We want to apply for a new job, promotion, position, but the uncertainty creates fear. We talk ourselves out of trying. You know where I'm headed. It's time for a little reflection. Let's play the good music, the brainstorm music. And my challenge to you is think of a few times that this has happened to you. When has fear, discomfort, and all these tough emotions robbed you of an opportunity to grow? Hold on though. Jack, stop the music real quick. One tip. Remember that we're talking about learning. I just did this same exercise with a group of high-level executives from like a Fortune 50 company. Now, sometimes people in those roles have a hard time admitting they feel fear. So we come out of the brainstorm. I ask if anyone wants to share. A guy raises his hand and he goes, "Yeah, my lizard brain told me not to go hang gliding." Well, good, man. It's keeping you safe. We are not talking about being daredevils, reckless, or extreme sports. We're talking about learning. When has fear robbed you of an opportunity to grow? I honestly don't think there's an end to that brainstorm. If I gave you long enough, you could probably come up with 1,000 examples of when it's happened to you. Like I said, we've incorporated this message into our workshops for almost 7 years now. And so I've heard thousands of responses to that exercise. The three that have stuck with me the most. One was from a third grader. We went through this program with 12 third graders. It was awesome. This kid gets up, he goes, "I play baseball. And in every single game, I tell my coach I want to play in right field because no one ever hits the ball there." He kind of owned it. He's like, "I want to play in the infield, but I'm afraid if someone hits a ball at me, I might mess up. So I always volunteer to play right field." I keep going with the presentation. 2 minutes later, the kid stands up again. He has this weird look on his face and he goes, "My lizard tells me to play right field, doesn't it?" And it was this awesome aha moment. It's like, yeah, dude, that's exactly what's happening. We can all relate to that example where there was something we wanted to do, could do, should do. But when the time comes to do it, we end up in right field. That's the comfort zone. That's the zoo. We've all been there. We did this talk with a Major League Baseball team, their pitching staff. One of the best pitchers in Major League Baseball shared, he goes, "There's lots of times at the end of the game, the pressure's on, and I throw the easy pitch, not the right pitch. And that's cost us wins." I love these two examples because it illustrates a powerful point. Fear is universal. That's a third grade baseball player, a Major League Baseball player, both identifying times where the fear, the discomfort, the amygdala was really driving the car and making our decisions. A high school student from Des Moines, Iowa shared that she was in the final qualifying round to get on The Voice, the singing show. She had to sing one more song. If it goes well, she might make it on the show. It comes time for her audition. She freaks out and leaves. When she shared this in front of her classmates, there is a groan in the room. And I kind of understand where they're coming from. Like, this is a life-changing opportunity that she missed. But this really illustrates the truth about fear and this topic as a whole. It's easy to sit here and talk about what we could do and should do. And it's even easier to talk about what other people could do and should do. Easy for us to say, "Oh, he should play in the infield. He should throw the right pitch. She should sing the song." But the truth is, if we're in their shoes with their experiences, we probably do the same thing. In fact, we have. We've done the same thing. Maybe we haven't auditioned to get on The Voice. Of course we haven't, but we've all lost battles to discomfort and fear. I want to spend a couple more minutes on her example because I think there are some important takeaways for all of us. First of all, obviously, we have no idea what would have happened if she performs the song. Does she make it on the show? What judge turns around? Does she get a record deal? Is it going to actually change her life? No clue. We'll never know. But we do know two things. You can't make it on the show unless you sing the song. Just like you can't get the job unless you apply. You can't get into the school unless you send in the application. Fear robs us of potential outcomes. What else did the fear rob her of, though? Yeah, the experience. If she gets on the stage, if she performs the song, that's a moment she can draw back on later in life. In another situation, another high-pressure situation, she could remember, yo, I did that. That earned confidence only comes from performing the song, stepping into the jungle, and doing the thing. And the really cool thing is, that isn't entirely dependent on the outcome. It's more about just doing the thing. Going through the interview process, every single time you do it, you get a little bit better. Every time you do it is a rep. You're practicing the skill of going through the interview process. Those reps are valuable whether you get the job or not. Now, of course, it hurts like crazy to not make it on the show, to not get the job, but the value is in the action. And big picture, that's what fear is robbing us of all the time. So if we want to become a better learner, we have to figure out a way to fix this. Chapter 10, How to Overcome Fear. I first learned about this topic from a guy named Seth Godin. In the world of business and marketing, he's like one of the most brilliant people. I think he has 19 best-selling books at this point. He had the most read blog in the world for like 5 years straight. The guy is unbelievable. 7 years ago, I actually got to interview him. It was one of the coolest days of my life. Like, I got to meet my hero. Now, some interesting things happened during the interview. First, I forgot to hit record.
I kind of messed up the start of the video. If you could give that 30-second intro to the lizard brain again, I'm so sorry. You nailed it, and I was so excited.
All right. You got everything else, though?
Everything else is so good, and
all right.
I'm so sorry.
After ironing out the technical difficulties, he taught me about the lizard brain and fear. I wish there was a way that you could see the footage from this interview. Because while he's going through this topic, my eyes are the size of tennis balls. It was connecting with me big time. Tons of aha moments. One was like, wow, this is a big reason we zoo tiger. The other thing I realized is, yeah, we talk about fixed mindset and fear separately, but those two things actually work together. Stories can create fear. Fear can create stories. Sometimes our story is, I'm not a math person. But the truth is, that's a mask for my fear. The truth is, I might be just afraid to be bad at this topic. And it can also work in the reverse. Maybe my story is I'm not a people person, which makes me afraid of speaking in front of others. And the biggest reason this conversation with Seth hit home is because I, probably like you are right now, started to think about all the times in my life where fear sent me in the wrong direction. For the intro of the book, I came out of the gates with my story of trying to walk onto the Duke basketball team. But what I didn't tell you is I almost transferred out of Duke, almost had to take an extra year because I was struggling so much in the classroom. I grew up in Lander, Wyoming. Shout out because I know some of you are listening to this. Lander, Wyoming, super small town in the mountains of Wyoming. And going to college in Durham, North Carolina was a big leap out of my comfort zone. It's over 2,000 miles from home. And at the time I was there, I think there was only one person on the entire campus besides me that was from the state of Wyoming. So I'm way out in the jungle, way out of my comfort zone. And when we're there, stories and fear pop up. Stories like, I don't belong here. Everyone is better than me. Everyone is smarter than me. Everyone is richer than me. That one was true. And during my first year of classes, at my dream school, I never said one word in a class for the entire year. Why? Stories and fear. I had this big idea that if I say the wrong thing, they would know I was the kid from Wyoming that didn't belong. Of course, no one really thought that, but that's where I was at. And that robbed me of a year of getting better at a really, really good school. So let's go back to the interview with Seth Godin. He teaches me about fear. I flash back to that experience, what do you think I asked him next? Actually, a better question. We've been talking about fear for 20 minutes and 17 seconds. What do you want to know next? I hope what you're thinking is, okay, we get it, but what do we do about it? This would be a pretty garbage chapter if I just went for 30 minutes saying, yeah, fear's the worst. Good luck out there. Keep learning. So I hope you're feeling a bit impatient, because that's where I was too. I get it. I understand it. Yeah, it affects me. But what do we do about it? And that's the question I asked Seth. My logic was, wow, fear made me bad at learning. If I could remove the fear, I could be good at learning. So the question I asked him, word for word, how do you kill the lizard brain? How do you become fearless? Here's his actual response.
So I'm thrilled you asked the question that way, because that is exactly the wrong question. If you are seeking to destroy, defeat, conquer the lizard brain, you will fail. It cannot be done, because when you try to fight the lizard brain, you are giving it more power. Your brain is nothing but a chemistry experiment. It's electricity and chemicals. And when you push back on the lizard brain, when you try to reason with the lizard brain, when you just say one more this or one more that or don't worry, it inflames and releases more chemicals. You cannot win. What you can do is dance with the lizard brain. What you can do is realize that the lizard brain is a compass. And then when it freaks out, it is telling you you are on to something. When it freaks out, it's telling you you're about to do something that's brave and bold and powerful. And you should listen to it by doing the opposite of what it wants you to do. That when we listen for the lizard brain and welcome it and thank it for giving us a clue, then we can use it to our own ends. So if you talk to the great artists of all time, of any time, what you see is they do their best work in the moments when part of their brain is telling them it will never work, they'll never amount to anything, they're a fraud, they're going to get caught, they're afraid. Those are the moments you say, yes, thank you, and do it anyway.
The fear, the discomfort, the tough emotions hold a ton of power over our actions and decisions and how we learn. But we can't really fight them. We can't really deny them. We can't really get rid of them. But what we can do is learn to accept and understand and dance with them. We take the power back by understanding and accepting, not by fighting and suppressing. And if we take a step back, this approach makes logical sense. If we know that the lizard wants to keep us in the zoo, if we ever do get into the jungle, of course it's going to freak out. The freak out is a sign that we're out of our comfort zone. It's called a comfort zone for a reason. If we're out of the comfort zone, it's no longer comfortable. The key here is in how we interpret the feeling. Sort of our old school approach to thinking about tough emotions and fear is, oh, if I feel them, I'm doing something wrong. I'm weak. I'm not ready. With our upgraded approach, we realize, oh, feeling fear, feeling discomfort, that's a sign I'm out of my comfort zone. Hey, just a quick little footnote, little disclaimer. There's a time and a place for all of this. If you're in danger, please don't dance with your fear. Please listen to the lizard brain. It's doing its job. We're not condoning reckless behavior, putting yourself into danger. This is a tool to use when we're trying to learn. Thanks. Back to the book. So here I am. And I'm telling you, we need to understand and feel and accept our tough emotions. That's a 180 from how I used to talk about this. I would go around to groups and just like everyone say, you need to be fearless. Don't be afraid. Calm down. Don't worry. Now that we've looked at the mechanics of fear and discomfort and understand a bit about how they work, what's wrong with that approach? Hopefully you're seeing that there are dozens of problems with this traditional approach. In fact, Jack, play the chapter music. We need to do this properly and devote an entire chapter to it. Chapter 11, The Flaws of Fearless. We've been framing this under the umbrella of be fearless, don't be afraid, calm down. But those are all just symptoms of a bigger sort of mindset or perception that society has towards tough emotions. The bigger perception is it's bad to feel bad. tough emotions are a bad or negative thing. And there's lots of ways that we're sold this message.
Okay, it's happening. Everybody stay calm.
What's the procedure, everyone? What's the procedure?
Stay calm!
Wait. We can't have anyone freak out there, okay? We've got to keep our composure.
Sometimes it is, be fearless. Other times, don't be afraid. Sometimes it's, be tough. Other times it's, always be happy. Always be positive. All of these signals in one way or the other are funneling down to this big idea that we have that the optimal strategy is to get rid of / don't feel these tough emotions. And on paper, yeah, it kind of makes sense. But if you dig into it and look at the actual research, a lot of problems arise. To help me out with this section, I'm bringing in two of literally the world's leading experts in the field. We have Mark Brackett, who's the director of the Center of Emotional Intelligence at Yale. And we have Susan David, who's a psychologist at Harvard Medical School. So we kind of have the dream team here. Now let's get into these problems. Problem one with the be fearless / don't feel approach. You can't really do it. If we're doing something that involves uncertainty, attention, change, struggle, we're going to feel something. You can kind of name the feeling what you want, but the feeling is there. The only way to feel nothing is to not do it or completely not care. And obviously, that's not what we want. In fact, if we're being real, caring is a multiplier of feeling. If we care and it involves uncertainty, we will feel. If you look into the research of tough emotions like stress, anxiety, fear, you see piles of studies that show one of the worst possible approaches is to try to suppress these. They hook people up, put them into stressful situations. Groups that are told to try to suppress those feelings react even stronger.
But there's this effect in psychology, and the effect is called amplification. Imagine you've got a delicious piece of chocolate cake in the refrigerator. The more you try not to think about it, the greater its hold on you. So we know when people push aside difficult emotions, that kind of internal pain doesn't just go away. It tends to actually come back and it tends to become suffocating. You tend, when you try to push aside these difficult emotions, have an amplification or even what turns out to be emotional leakage.
And the problem with don't worry, calm down, be fearless, don't be afraid, don't feel is essentially what we're saying is don't feel how you're feeling. And the next logical approach is we attempt to suppress, which can amplify the feelings and usually make them worse. Perhaps the biggest problem is this creates a lot of shame around our emotions.
So yes, there's different types of emotions that I talk about. You know, type one emotions are the clean, clear experience of the emotion. I'm unhappy. I'm unsad. I feel anxious. You know, I'm grieving. And that's just the emotion. That is what it is. Type two is when we start having emotions about our emotions. I'm unhappy about the fact that I'm unhappy. I'm sad and I shouldn't feel sad because other people have got it worse. And type two emotions are when we really start getting ourselves into trouble. We start developing this internal struggle that keeps us stuck and that stops us from being able to learn in our lives because we're so busy hustling with ourselves and with our emotions and what we're allowed to feel or not allowed to feel, that we aren't facing into the reality or gaining new skills or connecting.
Before I learned all this, I was a mess before every single one of my talks. I would be backstage and I would be feeling really nervous. And I interpreted those nerves as a sign of weakness. I'm not prepared. I don't belong. I'm not smart enough. I'm too young. Imposter syndrome level 10, type 2 emotions, snowballing out of control. Miriam Greenspan calls this emotion phobia, where we really start to fear our tough emotions. We feel like we always need to be happy, always need to be positive, or we're doing something wrong. Some people call this toxic positivity.
On the surface of it, saying, oh, let's be positive sounds great, but what is it actually doing? It's perpetuating denial. It's perpetuating this incapacity for us as individuals to be authentically with our experience, which sometimes is difficult because life is fragile and learning can be tough. And, you know, we all have our hearts broken or we become ill. And so we need as human beings to develop the skills to help us deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be.
This is just layer one of the problems caused by the don't feel approach. Where are we at so far? We said, problem one, can't really do it because we're human and we're wired to feel emotions. Problem two is it leads to suppression, and suppression usually makes it worse. And problem three, it creates shame and we begin to fear our fear, fear the tough emotions. Layer two is because we're armed with this perception that it's bad to feel bad, we come up with a bunch of strategies to stop feeling these emotions.
So that's all, you know, going to the kind of maladaptive, you know, self-destructive strategies, you know, whether it be, you know, too much alcohol, denial, suppression, repression, you know, acting out, screaming, overeating, you know, the list goes on. And by the way, you don't need to even get a bachelor's degree to become an expert, you know, in these strategies. You know, we learn them just by observing our families and the world around us, because they're a lot easier, right? It's a lot easier to use these, you know, mostly ineffective strategies.
I call these pain relievers, actions and behaviors we can do to stop feeling. One of the biggest, and I learned this one from Brené Brown, she calls it hiding. Hiding is we stop doing the thing that causes the tough emotions. I apply for a job. I don't get it. That causes the tough emotions. I stop applying for jobs. I miss a few three-pointers in the basketball game. Makes me feel kind of weird. I stop shooting. And to bring this full circle back to learning, if we're denying, offloading, blaming, numbing, and hiding, it's almost impossible to grow.
You know, when our brains are preoccupied with defending and denying and repressing and suppressing, they're not available for learning.
So the big idea here is it's not our emotions that are causing these problems. It's the way we interpret the emotions. These problems are caused by our flawed assumption that it's bad to feel bad, that we shouldn't feel these tough emotions. And as we learned in the growth mindset chapter, we need to attack this problem at the mindset level, not at the behavior level. The behavior level would have been Trevor 3 years ago telling you, don't deny, don't offload, don't blame, don't hide. What we need to do here is go to the root and make a big mindset shift from tough emotions, stress, anxiety, fear, are a sign of weakness, to tough emotions are human, adaptive, and oftentimes useful. Exactly what Seth Godin told us in the interview. Now, I know that sounds good. You can make a t-shirt, dance with fear, dance with the lizard brain. But there is a lot of really, really good research backing up that statement. So coming up, we're going to dive into the actual science. We're going to hear from some of the researchers. We're going to connect a few dots and hopefully end this segment in a place where you understand the mindset shift and how to put this theory into practice. Chapter 12. Putting emotions in the backseat.
I'm Jeremy Jameson. I'm an associate professor at the University of Rochester. I tend to research the intersection of affective science, social psychology, and psychophysiology.
Jeremy Jameson did a study at Harvard Business School. Really simple.
So we were looking at students who were preparing for this, maybe it's a stressful occurrence where you're taking a standardized test that has a lot of importance for whether you're going to get into different grad schools or not. And so what we did is we took a sample of people who were preparing for that, and we brought them to the lab to do sort of a practice test.
There's two groups of students. Group one receives the math section of the practice GRE. They're given no special training or instructions. Just here you go, finish the test. They score a 684 out of 800. The second group is given the same set of questions, but on top of their exam is one paragraph of instructions teaching them to what Jeremy calls reappraise the stress.
Which really telling people that, like, yeah, you're going to be, it's stressful. I'm not trying to pretend that, like, this test isn't stressful. It's stressful. You're going to be highly aroused. You're going to be sort of like, your heart's going to be beating fast. Your palms will be sweaty, but that's fine. And so it's more of like, that's actually good. It's not like this is bad. It's not something to be avoided. This is good. If you were disengaged and you didn't care, that'd be bad.
Group two scores a 739. A decent boost in performance coming from one paragraph. The wild thing is, 3 months later, the students took the real GRE.
So they go off, they take the real test, and then they come back and they gave us their ETS, their score reports. And they did, we had the same pattern. They did better on the quantitative section, on like the real GRE test.
This was one study, one day, one paragraph. But 3 months later, the students that read the paragraph did better than the students that didn't.
But the interesting thing about it is that it's really understanding a lot of the way we respond emotionally, affectively, stress responses. These aren't like isolated boxes. Like they're like kind of like how I respond to situation one affects how I do in situation two. And it kind of, it cycles. It's a recursive process. And so if you can teach people and give them the tools to adapt, more adaptively respond in one stressful situation, they can kind of take that with them and apply it to other situations. Like Greg Wald and Jeff Cohen, they have some work where they're finding effects 2 years later for like a 30-minute intervention. And it's like, how does this work? And like, it works like that. You're changing people the way they're engaging with their world. Ali Kroom at Stanford, she has some wonderful work on this. So her work is on stress mindsets.
Ali Kroom out of Stanford looked at this in the workplace. In her study, there were two groups of people. Group one watched a series of videos that really framed stress traditionally as a negative thing, a debilitating thing. The second group watched a series of videos that framed it as a more positive thing, showed the benefits or the reasons we feel stressed. And this group, the one that was taught to sort of reframe stress, actually saw improved health and work performance. Allison Wood Brooks from Harvard Business School. Her name might sound familiar. She's the one that did the survey we mentioned at the top of this segment. In a series of studies, she wanted to look at the difference between this reappraisal tactic that Jeremy was talking about and suppression. So Jeremy was looking at reappraisal versus really nothing, the control group. Allison Wood Brooks wanted to look at, well, what's the difference between reappraising and attempting to suppress these tough emotions? So she picks three activities that create a lot of discomfort for people: public speaking, a math test, and singing. And in each three of the activities, the group that's taught to reappraise, to reframe the stress, performs better than the group that's really framing it as a negative, the group that's told to calm down, to relax. I think one of the most interesting studies in this series, she has you go into a room. There's someone you don't know in the room. A Nintendo Wii is hooked to a TV. You have to stand in front of the person and sing Don't Stop Believing to them.
She's just a small town girl living in a lonely world.
Incredibly uncomfortable. The control group, the one that's taught to really frame and appraise stress traditionally, that it's a negative thing, they score a 53% on the song. The reappraisal group, the one that's taught to reinterpret these tough emotions, scores an 81%. That's a 30% boost in performance coming from an adjustment to the way they think and talk about the fear, the discomfort, the stress. I think the most compelling thing about this research is in many of these studies, they hook the participants up and they're measuring sort of their physiological response. And in study after study, they see no significant difference between any of the groups. Everybody's heart rate goes up. Everyone's blood pressure goes up. So big picture, everyone's kind of feeling the same. And that's the big takeaway of this entire segment of the book. We don't have much control over how we feel, but what we can control is the way we interpret those feelings. Go back to the singing study. Imagine you're in the group that's really framing this stress and discomfort as a negative thing. You feel like it's bad to feel this way. And then you're in the room that's designed to make you uncomfortable. Your perception is, I shouldn't feel, but then you do feel. Where is your attention going to be? Yeah, on the stress, on the emotions. Why am I feeling this? How do I stop it?
And so the only reason the sort of stress reappraisal stuff works is because people don't think stress is useful. And so what they try to do is they try to like ignore it. They try to like get rid of it. They sort of like pay attention to the stress rather than pay attention to doing what they need to do.
Now imagine you're in the group that's given permission to be nervous, permission to feel. They're in the same room, singing the same song, feeling the same way as the other group. But because they were given permission to be nervous, they could turn their attention to the task.
There's a step before developing the skills of emotional intelligence, which is, you know, we have to give ourselves the permission to have all feelings and not judge them, right? There's no such thing as a bad feeling or a weak feeling. Feelings are feelings, period. Everyone needs to learn these ruler skills, whether you're a CEO, whether you're a coach, whether you are a teacher, a lawyer, boxer. I mean, anybody who breathes. I mean, I really believe that. These skills apply to every context. You're going to have better health and better well-being. You're going to have better relationships, make better decisions. You're going to be more creative, perform better.
For more of these strategies, please check out Mark's fantastic book, Permission to Feel. I love the title. And as you can tell, we've been using that phrase a lot throughout these chapters.
See as far as possible if you can just do away with this idea that there's good or bad, that if you can just face into your experience in a way that's compassionate, you know, this tough thing happened to me or is happening to me, and I'm processing it and I'm learning from it. I didn't wish this thing on myself, but now that I'm dealing with it, I'm developing a sense of understanding around it. And that comes not from the place of pushing aside difficult emotions. That comes from the place of compassion with ourselves. It comes from the place of courage, because sometimes we needed to face into experiences that are really difficult or situations that we know aren't going in the way that we wanted. And it also comes from the place of curiosity. You know, what is my emotion telling me here? It's not just about bearing these difficult emotions. It's actually about recognizing that these emotions are very often gifts. You know, what do they bring with them? They bring with them signposts of the things that we value and we care about.
In her book, Emotional Agility, Susan also explains, look, emotions are data, not directives. We can use them for information. We don't have to listen to every single thought or emotion we have, but we must be open to feeling them.
The context changes, our lives change, and we change. And so it's only when we open to the difficult emotions that come as part and parcel with being human that we are able to then adapt to that change. And that is the cornerstone of learning. That is the cornerstone of adaptability.
I think it was so cool that I actually got to interview most of these researchers. I look at them as sort of the avengers of stress and discomfort. Technically, they are looking at it from different angles. Jeremy Jameson, Allison Wood Brooks, they're looking at reappraisal, how we think about our emotions before a challenge. Susan David and Mark Brackett are looking at sort of our tough emotions that we experience during a really tough setback or difficult situation. And Ali Kroom is sort of looking at the way we think about stress and tough emotions as a whole. And where I'm at is, yeah, they're kind of looking at different things, but they're all pointed in the same direction. That one of the most important things we can do is shift the way we think and talk about tough emotions. Liz Gilbert explains this perfectly in her book, Big Magic.
I even have a welcoming speech prepared for fear, which I deliver right before embarking on any new project or big adventure. And it goes like this. Dearest Fear, creativity and I are about to go on a road trip. I understand you'll be joining us, because you always do. I acknowledge that you believe you have an important job to do in my life and you take your job seriously. Apparently your job is to induce complete panic in me whenever I'm about to do anything interesting. And may I say, you are superb at your job. So by all means, keep doing your job if you feel you must, but I will also be doing my job on this road trip, which is to work hard and stay focused. And creativity will be doing its job, which is to remain stimulating and inspiring. There's plenty of room in the minivan for all of us, so make yourself at home. But understand this, creativity and I are the only ones who will be making any decisions along the way. I recognize and I respect that you're part of this family. I will never exclude you from our activities, but still, your suggestions will not be followed. You are allowed to have a seat. You're allowed to have a voice, but you are not allowed to have a vote. You don't get to touch the roadmaps. You're not allowed to suggest detours. You're not allowed to fiddle with the temperature. Dude, you're not even allowed to choose the freaking snacks. But above all else, my dear old familiar friend, you are absolutely forbidden to drive. And then we head off together, me and creativity and fear, side by side by side, forever, marching once more into the terrifying but marvelous terrain of unknown outcome.
When our goal is to be fearless, to not feel these tough emotions, all sorts of problems arise. We're likely to avoid situations that cause discomfort. When we're in a challenging situation feeling tough emotions, that tends to suck up all of our focus and attention, and it creates shame. we start to fear our tough emotions. Our goal isn't to become fearless. We just don't want fear making our decisions when we're trying to learn. And we do that by flipping the script, making a mindset shift, and understanding that our tough emotions are there for a reason. They're adaptive. They can equip us for a challenge, and they can be signposts to learning opportunities. They are not something that we need to deny and suppress and run from. My best advice is to treat this as a skill. And just like any skill, we should start small. I'm not saying go home tonight, pick the thing that freaks you out the most, and do it tomorrow. No, we should start small and get some reps. Maybe we feel uncomfortable, but we ask more questions. We feel uncomfortable, but we have the tough conversation. As we get those reps of feeling, doing, we're getting better at this skill of dancing with these tough emotions. Nobody is perfect with it. I fail at this all the time. But once we're aware of this system, we can win a few more battles. I can't even begin to explain how much this topic has helped me. Now, before my talks, I kind of feel the same as I used to. I'm still pretty nervous, but I know the nerves are because I care, there's some uncertainty, there's some attention, and there's some struggle involved. I feel because I'm in the jungle. And that approach is much more effective than assuming it's because I don't belong. Adjusting the way we think and talk about the tough emotions is an essential tool to help us spend more time in the jungle, getting good at the things that matter to us. In our next section, we're going to explore the final fundamental tool for better learning. We'll see you then. This program is brought to you by thelearnerlab.com. The book is by Trevor Reagan. This episode was produced by Jack. For more resources on learning, please visit our website.